Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me to give this talk. It's really great to be back at Perimeter. And yeah, thanks to the organizers for setting up this conference. It's been a lot of fun having everyone who works on this all in one place discussing ideas. So yeah, I'm going to be talking about this work that was done in collaboration with Will Donnelly, Laurent Friedel, and Farouk Mousavian. There was a paper from about a year and a half ago here, and some upcoming work as well. So just to sort of give a standard review of some concepts that I think everyone's familiar with, you know, there's this idea that, of course, in gravity, diffeomorphisms are pure gauge. That means that there should be trivial charges associated with it. But as has been emphasized throughout this workshop, when you introduce boundaries, some of these diffeos become physical symmetries and you get non-trivial charges. So these charges have all sorts of relevance. You know, in the classical theory, these charges will describe things like quasi-local notions for energy and angular momentum if you're doing this for subregions in your theory. When you take the subregion to just be the full space-time with a boundary, like an asymptotic boundary, you can get global charges. Here you can get things like ADM mass or BMS charges if you're working at Scry. And you know, on finite boundaries, you get things like a Brown-York stress tensor that sort of characterizes the full set of these charges. And of course, these have applications to things like holography if you're doing interested in that sort of thing. And the stress tensor gets related to a CFT stress tensor. And from the quantum gravity side, at least one of the reasons I've been really interested in this is this idea of sort of Hilbert space factorization and the notion of entanglement entropy in gravitational theories. So the idea is one of the remnants of the fact that these diffeos are gauge, but basically means that in subregions, your Hilbert space is not going to factorize in a naive way into a subregion in its complement Hilbert space, and this is due to gauge constraints. And the charges that you describe here are sort of additional degrees of freedom that you add in order to impose this factorization of the Hilbert space. And so this has a relevance to discussing entanglement entropy, because now you've added extra degrees of freedom, and those degrees of freedom get entangled across the surface. And it leads to sort of a proposed formula for the entropy in these situations, where you sort of, there's this Donnelly formula when you specifically for when working with gauge theories, where this extended Hilbert space entropy splits into sort of a term that's the entropy in each sector, sort of a Shannon entropy associated with uncertainty and being in a different sector of the edge modes, and then there's sort of a third term that gives you the entanglement between the actual new degrees of freedom that you've added. And this is conjectured to possibly be relevant as being kind of the dominant contribution to the entropy in certain situations. So yeah, so things like this are sort of a motivation for understanding some of these edge modes and symmetry algebras in gravity. So the symmetry algebra I'm going to be focusing on in this work, in this talk, is this, what I'll call the surface-preserving diffeomorphisms. So this, if we take sort of a subregion, a local subregion in gravity, this is going to be defined by a codimension 2 surface that I've drawn in red. The subregion is sort of the blue region inside. And sort of, yeah, you're on a time slice, and that kind of defines a domain of dependence of that codimension 2 surface, and that's what you'll call your subregion. And the symmetry algebra here, and unfortunately, after Rob's talk, I am using a somewhat incompatible notation here, but there is a universal, which I'll explain what that means in a second, symmetry algebra that appears. Here, universal, I'm saying this appears for any diff invariant theory. So it shows up sort of independently of the, you know, if you have a higher curvature theory, you'll always find a set of charges that are associated with diffeomorphisms of the 2 surface and SL2R transformation. So I've kind of sketched how these diffeos are acting near the surface. The diff of S are the ones that are tangent as you get close to the surface, whereas the SL2R transformations are these sort of various types of boosts in the normal plane. Okay, and so Rob mentioned a more a sort of overarching bigger group that, and this is sort of a subgroup of the ones that actually fix the surface's location. And this is going to be the one that I'm focusing on in this talk. So for the diff-S, when you're working with general relativity, in Laurent's talk, he mentioned that he reviewed some of the charges here. The diff-S charges are sort of an infinite dimensional generalization of angular momentum, and there's sort of a connection-like quantity that Laurent wrote down describing those charges. And then the SL2R charges are roughly some sort of local area element. And so the first step in trying to understand how to use this symmetry algebra in the quantization is we sort of wanted to understand what the representations of this symmetry algebra is. And in order to tackle that question, one thing we looked at was this looking at the coadjoint orbits of this specific group here. And so yeah, thanks to Andrea's talk on Monday, we had a nice review of coadjoint orbits, so I won't go into the details, but I will say that yeah, we gave a classification of the coadjoint orbits of this group in this work from a couple years ago. And then one of the neat things is that this classification result that we have here sort of closely parallels this classification of the Poincaré orbits as well, which luckily were also reviewed on Monday. So I can go through this sort of quickly. So the idea is both groups have this semi-direct product structure, and that sort of percolates through to giving a sort of a parallel between the two classifications. And so in the Poincaré, you have a what we call a homogeneous Casimir, which is the Casimir associated with the momenta of the translation, and this is just the mass. And the associated object would be the Casimir, the quadratic Casimir of the SL2R element, which was identified in the paper from, well, a while ago by Laurent and Will. This is just the area element of the surface. And then you can restrict to the little group that sort of preserves this Casimir. So in the case of massive representations, that's just SO3 for Poincaré. And the associated object for us, and this is going to be relevant throughout this talk, is this area-preserving subalgebra. So it's the thing that sort of locally preserves the area element here. In the case of Poincaré, there is a generator of this little group, so this Pauli-Lubensky vector, which is a vector that's orthogonal to the momentum, and it generates the SO3 that preserves a given momentum here. And for us, the associated object is this outer curvature object that Laurent mentioned in his talk. Here I've expressed it just to show you that you can construct it out of the space-time and extrinsic curvatures. I'm using what's known as the Ricci equation. There's also an intrinsic way to write this.
I had a question about, in what sense this group is a symmetry? So you said that you have this diffeomorphism group that acts on the metric, and to call it a symmetry, I would have to build a charge.
You write down a phase space associated with the subregion, and then you just act, you contract with a diffeo generator, and you see that there's a Hamiltonian generating the symmetry on this local phase space.
Okay, so yeah. In like it's a covariant phase space analysis.
Yeah, covariant phase space. Okay. So given that we already went over that on Monday, I won't show any of those formulas.
I just wanted to make sure which type of symmetry.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry, just to clarify, the area here is the analog of the choice of a time-like vector that the little group stabilizes more than.
Yeah, like the area element, I guess, would be the actual vector, I guess.
More than the momentum vector. The analogy would be more like. You're putting in analogy.
Maybe like a unit vector. It would be like the unit vector,
okay.
Say, something like that.
And are there also, that's not the only little group in the Poincaré group. Are there also other choices of little groups here?
That would be, you would have area elements that are not positive definite or vanishing at locations. I mean, actually, Laurent mentioned something about discrete support of that. But so the one we're focusing on, since it seems to make most sense in classical gravity, is the positive area ones. And that's the analog of the massive reps here. Okay, and then just to mention, once you have this outer curvature object, the invariants that you now form that are sort of Casimirs for the entire group are the analog of this, the norm of the the Pauli-Lebansky vector, which is just this spin in the case of massive representations. And here you just have this curvature scalar on the surface and you take its moments, and then these are what we would call the generalized entropies. So when you set k equal to 2, that's the thing people usually call the entropy in a fluid context. Okay, and so this is sort of a nice result that classifies these orbits. And so in principle, this should inform the representation theory of this group. So going forward from here, I'm going to, you know, one approach would be, okay, now just go through the procedure of, say, geometric quantization of these orbits. And basically what I'm saying for this talk is I'm not going to do that, and I'll give you a few justifications of what we're doing instead and why. Essentially, what we're gonna look for before just straight up trying to find the representations of this algebra is to sort of come up with a regularized algebra. And the idea here is, like, you might expect quantum effects to, in principle, for when you have large symmetry algebras like this, the quantum effects can deform the symmetry algebra after quantization, especially if you can show that such a deformation, a well-defined deformation exists. And this is also something that shows up in other computations of entanglement entropy, and in particular when people look at using edge modes to define entanglement entropy for Maxwell theory, they always have in mind something like a lattice regulator. And in that case, you're replacing this infinite dimensional boundary gauge symmetry algebra with a finite dimensional one where it's just the lattice sites and you have a group at each lattice site. The idea is we don't want to do something like a lattice regulator because it doesn't play well with diffs, but we'll explain exactly what's going on with this deformation as I go through the talk. The other motivation is just generic ideas of Planckian and fuzziness. You might expect that this continuum description in terms of diffeomorphism algebras breaks down at small scales. There's also motivations from things like matrix models and string theory where, you know, there's sort of just generic fuzziness as you get to from quantum gravity effects. And the last one I'll admit is just a practical motivation. There's really not much to my knowledge on the studying the unitary reps of a group like the one I wrote down. And so it's nice to look for a finite dimensional one that is more tractable. So what I'll explain what we're doing for the rest of the talk is we'll look for a deformation, and we'll look for a deformation of actually a subalgebra, where instead of looking at all diffs, we're going to look at the area-preserving subalgebra, semi-direct the SL2R transformations, and we'll kind of see why. Well, it's just because basically we're going to use things about known deformations of this area-preserving subalgebra to construct the one that we're interested in. And I'll try to go through how you identify this deformed algebra and roughly sketch how this deformed algebra is used in the quantization of your phase space. So the motivation, like I said, comes from this result, and it's basically these results on the fuzzy sphere. And so the idea behind the fuzzy sphere, the way I like to think of it is, again, as we saw on Monday, that the sphere is a phase space. It's actually a coadjoint orbit of the group SU2. And this phase space, if you look at all symplectomorphisms, is just the full symmetry algebra is area-preserving diffeomorphisms of that sphere. And so the structure constants of sort of the functions on the sphere, here you can just label them by Y alpha, your spherical harmonics, and just remember throughout this talk that alpha is this sort of label that has both an angular momentum, total angular momentum, and spin angular momentum quantum numbers, which I'll give capital A and lowercase a associated with an index alpha. So you can write down structure constants just for the commutative product of two functions on the sphere. That's what this E will denote. And you have the Poisson bracket, which is the thing that gives you the area-preserving diffeomorphism algebra. Those structure constants will be denoted C. And the idea behind the fuzzy sphere is you basically quantize this sphere as a phase space. You get, since it's a coadjoint orbit of SU2, you get a representation of SU2 that's roughly in a given spin. And so each function on the sphere is replaced by an n by n matrix. And the commutator is basically the reality condition for a real function on the sphere, kind of translates to the fact that you have a Hermitian matrix in this prescription. And so the set of all of these matrices are just all the Hermitian matrices, and so you're gonna get an SUN Lie algebra. Okay, and there's sort of some really remarkable formulas when you dig into the fact that how this this fuzzy sphere works. So you can write down in this spherical harmonic basis the structure constants just for the matrix product. It has this incredibly simple expression in terms of a 3J and 6J symbol for SU2. And here, this J parameter is like the spin of the representation. It's related to N by this relation here. And so, yeah, you have this very explicit expression for these multiplication structure constants. And the idea is, as you take J to infinity in this expression, you're going to recover these structure constants that you find here, kind of somewhat remarkably. I mean, it's remarkable when you just look at the details of how the combinatorics works and whatnot, but it's sort of obvious from the perspective of quantization because this is what had to happen. So there's kind of getting this to work, you have to find the correct, you know, identity for this 6J symbol. So at some point we dug through and found a really convenient way of expressing this 6J symbol that gives a nice asymptotic expansion. By the way, this 6J symbol, it's sort of a funny limit where you're taking three of the legs here to infinity, but you're trying to keep the other three finite. So if you're imagining this as a tetrahedron, you're kind of taking the tetrahedron to be very long and skinny, and then you have a little triangle at the top of it. But so yeah, okay, you can go through how this expansion works and you find at leading order in 1 over n, you get the symmetric product for the functions on the sphere. And at the first sub-leading order in 1 over n, we get the Poisson bracket. And this is exact, and then there's order n to the minus 2 corrections. And this is exactly the form of sort of a Moyle product of a deformation quantization of a phase space. And you can even read off by looking at this coefficient that h bar is actually equal to the area of the sphere over 2 pi n. And this is exactly, okay, if you put n on this side and h bar on the other side, this is the relation between the dimension and area of the phase space that we saw from the quantization condition on Monday. And it's kind of nice that we sort of had some new developments on how you do this 6J symbol expansion, and we have sort of a way of seeing that you can get all of the expected subleading corrections in 1 over n as are expected of a Moyle product. So that was kind of an interesting upshot of this work. But basically, the conclusion here is that the structure constants for SUN approach those of the area-preserving diffeomorphisms of the sphere as n goes to infinity. Alternatively, you can say area-preserving diffeomorphisms admit a deformation to SUN. So going forward from here, we want to try to leverage this. No, oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, there is a question. So in the large limit, no, you can also introduce a parameter. There is a, you can create a class of non-isomorphic infinite dimensional algebras. Do you think maybe, I mean, I think it should work also in SUN. So I'm more familiar with SLN. In the case of SLN, you get this family of HS lambda algebras that are
sorry,
used.
What kind of algebra? Sorry.
So when you take the limit n going to infinity, you can keep a one parameter, you can obtain a one parameter family of non-isomorphic algebras.
Uh-huh.
Do you think it may make sense to have a parameter that there may be some quantum algebras that come out?
Is the parameter like a quantum group parameter, or is it something, some other parameter? What is the...
It's just that if you rescale your generators in the n going to infinity, you can introduce a parameter inside the rescaling and it gives you a one parameter family of non-isomorphic algebras.
Okay.
He has that, that's the H bar. What you call lambda is what he calls the H bar. So this is...
So is H bar, but it's...
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, H bar, the one parameter family is, it's a sequence of algebras, but it's just SUN if you're saying it's H bar. Yeah.
Once your idea is a Moyle product, then it's...
Yeah, you're sort of that. So I don't know if that's the same as what you're referring to, but maybe we should just talk after. Yeah. Okay. okay, so the idea is we want to try to leverage this result to find the deformation of the larger algebra that I wrote down. So the idea is the generators, by just focusing on this SL2R factor of this symmetry group, all this thing is basically SL2R valued functions on the sphere, and the Lie bracket is just the pointwise Lie bracket of these functions. So you can parameterize a generator of the continuum algebra as an SL2R generator times a spherical harmonic on the sphere, so just the function here. And then you compute the bracket pointwise, so you have the symmetric product of the matrices, or the functions on the sphere, and the Lie bracket epsilon of the SL2R pieces. So that's the classical bracket for those generators. And the idea is, okay, let's just take the ansatz that we just replace this spherical harmonic with its fuzzy version on the sphere. So we replace this by an n by n matrix. The taus are, say, two by two matrices in the fundamental or the defining rep of SL2. And so the new generators are going to be these 2n by 2n matrices that are this tensor product here. And so, okay, you have a bunch of matrices, you can just compute the commutator. And so what do you find is you find that the commutator splits into a part that looks exactly like this. Okay, once you're careful with how I shows up when you do the representations in terms of, yeah, quantum versus classical, but you see the classical structure constants here appear, and then there's a correction at order 1 over n, and a set of new generators that were not given by these tau times the y alphas. This is just the identity times the y alpha. But these now are just going to satisfy an algebra of area-preserving diffeomorphisms, because these are essentially just the functions on the sphere. Or not area preserving, but SUN, because these are just ordinary fuzzy spherical harmonics. So we say, okay, let's just add these generators to these ones, and that should give us a closed algebra. And indeed, so if you have these new generators, you compute their commutators, you get SUN. The way they act on these guys are exactly the way in the large N limit that the area preserving diffeos act on the SL2R guys here. And so basically that's, okay, we've basically shown from this argument that, okay, this term goes away when n goes to infinity. Since this approaches this, the other commutators you can show also approach it. So we've identified an algebra that approaches S diff times SL2R in the infinite n limit.
Anthony, yeah. You've got more or less 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. We'll go quick through the last part then. so yeah, just so we've identified an algebra, so the important fact now is we want to, we found an algebra of matrices, we want to figure out which algebra it is. Roughly the argument is, okay, you say SL2R is SU11, so the tau generators are going to preserve a 2 by 2 mixed signature Hermitian form, the Y alpha generators preserve the standard Hermitian form associated with SUN, and so roughly when you form these tensor product matrices, they're going to preserve this tensor product Hermitian form, which is looks like this. It has 1 here and minus 1 here. So you have a signature NN Hermitian form that's preserving. So the point is now the algebra is SUNN that we've identified. And so the conclusion is that the structure constants for SUNN in the large N limit approach our continuum algebra S diff times SL2R as N goes to infinity. Okay, so in the last 4 or so minutes, I want to sketch the procedure for how you can use this fact that you've identified a deformed algebra in order to say something about the quantization. And the idea is the idea of quantization is, so the classical theory, you have some Hamiltonians generating your symmetry algebra via the Poisson bracket, and the quantization, you want to replace every function on your phase space with operators acting on some Hilbert space in a unitary representation. The commutators of these operators are sort of the non-interesting piece. They're just supposed to just, you know, represent the symmetry algebra, but since you have operators on a Hilbert space, there's also a symmetric part of their product, and that's the thing that's sensitive to the representation that you chose for the symmetry algebra. And so you need to have a consistency condition that the full operator product needs to approach the commutative product up to order h-bar correction. And so this matching condition sort of determines the representation, and it will also, in principle, fix the deformation parameter n, so like which deformed group you're working with. And so in practice, it's simplest to impose this relation here on Casimir operators for the two symmetry algebras. Let's just explain this Casimir matching for the simpler case of SU2, because there we have a little bit, we can say a little bit more. So I'll just show the formulas for if you restore factors of area and G coming from the fact that this came from a gravitational phase space, you get sort of the normalization of these J's relative to the sort of quantized, the quantum generators. So anyways, once you're careful with restoring factors of area, G, and then this W was this outer curvature that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, you have the set of invariants, associated with those entropies. The deformed Casimirs are now just the Casimirs of SUN. And again, being careful with how the normalization and matching works, you can see that they scale with H bar N and this Casimir CK, where this is the standard expression of Casimirs of SUN in terms of elementary matrices, for example. And so the matching condition is you just need this thing to equal this thing up to, you know, order 1 over n in h-bar corrections. And that matching condition, in principle, fixes these numbers here, and that tells you which representation would be associated with your phase space. And so assuming the large n scaling of these Casimir operators for something like this, you expect them to go like n to the k minus 1 times little n, where that's the number of boxes in your Young diagram associated with the representation. You get a matching condition that says n has to scale like a over a pi g to the 1/3, and n has to scale like n squared. And so it would be interesting to carry this out more detail. In particular, there should be some relation between the Young diagram boxes and sort of the shape of the Young diagram and this outer curvature function on the sphere. I'm going to skip the SUNN matching, but basically there's also a classification of the Casimirs of SUNN. It's a little bit tricky it's tricky to get the Casimirs of also the classical algebra because we have sort of an additional structure. So it's a little bit different from the continuum Casimirs that we wrote down. But there's a similar procedure, and here basically the matching would be more of a technical issue SUNN representation theory I think is just more complicated, and so you'd have to have a good idea on how to construct reps of this deformed algebras, but in principle it exists and it's possible to do this matching there as well. Okay, so just to summarize, I showed you the existence of basically two types of deformations of these continuum algebras appearing in gravity and the quantized finite dimensional algebras. That was the new one was this one where the S diff times SL2R deforms to SUNN. I didn't talk about this, but there's sort of an intermediate algebra between these two where you restrict SL2R to just the boosts. So that's just R to the S, and we also showed that this deforms to SLNC times R. And maybe just to show some future works or future directions, there's this Casimir matching could be done in more detail, try to relate this Young diagram shape to this outer curvature function. You could also look at different topologies and how that affects the large N limit and how you can see that, again, in terms of the representations that are appearing. And it'd be nice to carry out some of this Casimir matching in more detail or between SUN and an SDIF. It also just, another question that this work brings up is how do you find similar deformations of these bigger symmetry algebras? So I restricted to area preserving diffeos because that was the one that we have kind of a known deformation in terms of SUN. But there's an interesting question is, does that lift to the diffeomorphisms? Can we lift it to this diff times SL2R? Can we lift it to the true universal corner symmetry algebra, including the R2 or even the GL2R. And ultimately, one of the things you'd like to understand is, write down a representation and see if there's a accounting interpretation of the entropy in this. So anyways, I'll leave it there. So thanks.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the last point there. Can you go back two slides? Here. Yeah, so the formula at the bottom looks like you're writing entropy equal, goes like n cubed.
Right, yeah.
So do you have some reason why it would go like n cubed?
No, I think it's a little odd. I'm fairly certain that I got the end counting correct here, but I'm not sure we should take this too seriously. Basically, because that sounds like the entropy is a bit too big there. But I think indeed you'd have to look a little more detail to make sure that this is the right scaling associated with the limit. And it really, in some sense, this is only looking at the area preserving subalgebra, which I would expect to not really capture the full entropy. So really you would expect something smaller. And it might be when you're looking at the shapes here that you get a kind of a parametric suppression there. So this is sort of a proof of concept, but yeah, I think it might be worthwhile delving into that tilde there in a lot more detail. So, yeah.
Okay, but I mean, you might have tried to argue that, well, because this is a matrix theory, that it should scale like n squared.
Exactly, yeah. So this is a funny relation, I agree. but yeah, I wouldn't take it as the end result. I think it does need to be checked in more detail there.
I mean, n cubed does show up in a string context.
Okay, well, if you have an example, it would be good to to discuss. But.
All right. Are there other extremely urgent questions that cannot wait 1 hour? Like, you need to ask it now? No. Okay. Very good. Then we can thank Anthony again.